Maboff!
This is Scammapalooza. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au. And if you do enjoy the show, why not head to iTunes and leave a review? Before we get to the show, my apologies for not releasing any episodes for the last few weeks. I had my hard drive crash not once, but twice. My iPhone completely died and someone stole the number plates, meaning that I got pulled over 3 times on the way to the shop to get the damn computer fixed. However, I would like to make a very special thank you to the good folks at the Genius Bar and at Mac One for making what could have been a tedious and aggravating experience even more tedious and aggravating. Let's just get on with the show. Before David Blaine and Dynamo, before Derren Brown and Chris Angel, there was one man, Paul Zenon, the first magician to take magic to the streets and perform what is now known as street magic. In the late 90s, his television specials were aired around the world as he made his way of the streets of London performing extraordinary magic for very drunk people. The shows were irreverent, weird, unusual, and at the time, groundbreaking. Every douchey teenager with a deck of cards trying to hit on a girl in a bar owes a debt to Zenon. However, he's not just a magician. He's an actor, a writer, and, perhaps more than any of those things, a skeptic. A man who takes one look at the world of spiritual claims and extraordinary hoaxes and says, bullshit. On this episode of Scammapalooza, I get to sit down with my idol and talk magic, manipulation, and lawsuits with people who shall not be named. My name is Nicholas J. Johnson, and this is Scammapalooza. Thank you so much for joining me on Scammapalooza. You've traveled all the way around the world to Australia just for this podcast.
Just for this, yeah, and I'll be leaving in 10 minutes. It's been a long day.
Why are you in Australia? Why have you graced us with your presence?
I've just been doing a month in Canberra, it might have just been one night. doing a show called Le Clique in the famous Spiegel Tent, which is kind of a kind of cabaret circus sort of show, very much a sort of adult cheeky sort of thing. And I was kind of emceeing that. So, did a 3.5 weeks of that and then just in Melbourne to visit for a few days.
Excellent. Well, we are the beneficiaries of your visit. It's very exciting. One of the reasons I started this podcast was I just had a list of people that I wanted to have conversations with. And it's a bit weird to say to people, hey, can I ring you up and we'll just have a chat?
Sure.
So a podcast is like the perfect way to force people to be my friend.
Absolutely, yeah. And it's a lot easier doing it while here rather than, if it's your early morning and I'm drunk late at night over Skype or whatever, you know? Or vice versa.
Drunk Skype, the best. the best.
Only, the only sort.
Yeah. So you, you obviously have had a very long and interesting career. I think you're the father of what is now known as street magic. So doing card tricks for people and doing close up magic on the street for television shows. You and David Blaine.
I think we were kind of amongst the first ones there. I think the first special we did in the UK was 98, I think, something like that. So yeah, I did a few years of that, but I've kind of, that was a phase really, I started out doing presenting kids TV in the early 90s and then did the street magic sort of, late 90s, early 2000s, then other TV stuff. But I've always kind of, preferred live work, if anything, so doing both comedy and magic in the comedy club circuit and festivals and corporate world, all that kind of thing. So I think I'm just an adapter, basically, a survivor.
And most recently you did a one-man play about Jim Collins.
That's right, yeah. Well, my real family name is Collins, so that's why
behind the curtain.
Yeah, so a little this name jumped out at me when I was reading, I think it was a Monster Midway, the book, about William Lindsay Gresham, and there's a chapter about Houdini, but actually about the people behind the scenes who made the Houdini show happen. And his right-hand man, for 20 years near enough, was this guy, Jim Collins. So I kind of had this idea of writing a play about Houdini from his point of view. He's the perfect character to sort of tell the tale, but as I started writing it, there were a few things happened in my personal life that were kind of weird sort of parallel coincidences, really. So it ended up it's kind of a play about starting to write a play and not finishing writing the play. It's a story about me growing up in Blackpool in the northwest of England, a kind of tourist resort, working in a magic shop in the sort of mid mid-late 70s, and about my mentor, a guy called Bill Thompson, and the shop was called The House of Secrets. So it's a tale within a tale, but really enjoyed doing it. So it's the first time I've ended up with the audience crying. It might not actually be the first time, but for a different reason to previously, you know. And there's just a real buzz about doing a show that's got a bit more emotional depth to it, you know. So there's some humour in it as well, but, you know, if you can make people laugh and cry in an audience, that's a real, you know, a real bonus.
And that show really brings together a lot of different things that you love, because it's magic, obviously, which is why it's not the only thing you do. It's probably what you're most famous for, but then also theatre, and then also the idea of being a skeptic and being someone who looks at the world of the paranormal with a critical eye. Because I mean, Houdini and by extension Jim Collins, as we've talked about several times on the podcast, were involved in that.
I touched very lightly on that, but I think it's interesting because it's not out and out about skepticism, and in fact it's almost the opposite, in the sense that, you know, it's about a world of wonder. And I think there's a temptation for people to, you know, assume that skeptics are very clinical in their outlook on the world. I mean, they are to a certain extent, but that doesn't mean that they can't have a sense of wonder as well. You know, it's that whole idea that if you're an atheist, for example, you know, you don't appreciate a sunset, you know, which is obviously total nonsense, you know. You're right. The show pretty much is called Linking Rings, and it is just about, you know, different things that come together, but without a sense of mysticism about it, but still a sense of wonder.
How do you, as a skeptic and as a magician, how do you keep from becoming cynical, and how do you keep from losing that sense of wonder? Because we are you're surrounded every day by bullshit, and you see it everywhere, and I see it everywhere, and I find myself becoming very, very cynical very, very quickly. How do you avoid that? How do you keep that?
I don't think you necessarily have to avoid it. I think you can kind of use cynicism, you know, for the powers of good, if you believe in the powers of good. It's one of those things where I think, you know, you would tend to assume that someone who doesn't believe in a greater being, therefore has no sense of morals. That's something that's cited quite a lot of the time by skeptical believers, if you will, you know, by people that are into religion. But I think, you know, I like to think I've got a fairly strong moral standpoint, you know, and so I kind of use my cynicism by taking the mickey out of these things. I think humour is a very powerful tool, you know, in terms of satire or whatever. It's you know, ridicule is not necessarily a bad thing. It can be a positive thing in the same way that a Bill Hicks as a comedian might sort of level stuff at a religious topic. I think you can do the same with psychics as a comedy magician, oddly enough, you know. So I think, you know, it's a question of not just poo-pooing everything, for want of a better phrase. It's a question of taking your cynicism and directing it and using it to change things if you can.
We had Richard Sanders on the show the last episode, and he is an Australian skeptic and is involved with the Million Dollar Challenge. And
I met him a few years ago.
So he's obviously a skeptic, and I always got the impression that maybe he was a cynic at heart, and he was a, you know, a cruel, horrible man intent on destroying what little beauty remains in the world, and to take these people's precious misguided beliefs and crush them under his boot. But talking to him, he was extraordinarily patient, gave them the benefit of the doubt. Said they truly do probably believe that they have these abilities, and they have these, you know, they're not trying to scam people or con people, and also recognize some of the, you know, the faults and foibles of critical thinking, which is very surprising. Whereas you talk obviously about, you know,
I am here to crush people's beliefs.
Yeah, I mean, you talk about, you know, sarcasm and satire and mocking and so on. Do you think that works? I mean, do you think that works as a way of uncovering beliefs?
I don't think it works in the sense that you would change someone's belief who's a believer. But what it does is point out to people who may be on the fence the ridiculousness of certain things, certain claims, you know. There's a few big name comedians in the UK, people like Dara O'Brien and actually, you know, Tim Minchin from over here, who, you know, use satire about mediums and psychics very well. And so I think someone who maybe didn't have an opinion either way could have their opinion affected by that, you know. So that's got to be a good thing. So it stops more people, you know, sliding down that slippery slope into, you know, they might read their horoscopes for a bit of fun, but then, you know, what's the difference between that and going to see a psychic, you know, for a reading about your future, and then you get a lump in your neck and you go, oh, maybe faith healing works, and so it goes on, you know. You kind of issue rational science and medicine in favor of this stuff that, let's face it, people do lump it together. You know, if you believe in crystal therapy, then you're more likely to believe that you can contact dead people. It's just the way it works, you know.
Is there a danger of that becoming skeptic propaganda, for want of a better word, of because I mean I watch someone like, say, Ricky Gervais, and he says a lot of really intelligent, interesting things about religion.
Yeah.
But he will then also, what people will remember is that feeling of mockery and the feeling of, you know, this thing is stupid and dumb. And yeah, that's what they'll take away, rather than necessarily taking away the critical ideas.
Yeah, I think it can work both ways. And but I don't think that's necessarily a bad thing. It's not all that positive. But if they do remember that something is, you know, ridiculous for whatever reason, even if it's because some celebrity has mentioned that, and it stops them actually, you know, paying money to these people, then that's got to be a positive thing in general, I think.
Speaking more specifically, and I realize that there's some specific things that we can't talk about. Can I point out that you have been sued by people in the past for your opinions?
I haven't personally said, I've had legal action taken against me, but that hasn't gone to court, you know. So the major thing was a few years back. There was a big name psychic who I got asked to write an article for a major newspaper. Because they'd apparently been caught cheating on stage. And I stress the word apparently. And so I wrote an article about how mediums in general could be doing what they appear to do, you know, contacting dead people on stage for money. And the newspaper unfortunately added a couple of lines, sort of strap lines to it, so saying, you know, pretty much saying it was a fait accompli that this person had been caught cheating. And so they sued the newspaper, not me, over the article. But then kind of, you know, it went to almost as far as court, but the newspaper folded in the end. But the interesting thing about it was that the psychic actually settled for a lot less money than they were going for originally. And also the newspaper only withdrew part of the allegation, basically. So, meanwhile, the psychic admitted that they had in fact worn an earpiece on stage, which was the kind of gist of the whole thing anyway. They had to, really, because I had found some footage of them walking off a stage taking an earpiece out. So there was this kind of whole backwards and forwards thing. It's very much revolving around semantics, you know. What happens in the UK with this kind of libel situation, you know, it's a very archaic law over there. So if someone accuses you of libeling them, they don't have to prove anything if it goes to court. You know, when this happened, everyone's like, oh, it's great, they'll have to prove that they're psychic, you know, and they won't be able to do that. You know, no, they don't have to prove anything. So the onus is on the person there taking the action again to prove everything. And of course, you can't prove that they're not contacting dead children. You could potentially prove that they're cheating, but it would have to be on this specific night with really hard evidence, and that's really hard to do, you know. I mean, the accusation was that this medium was receiving information about the audience through an earpiece. That was all denied. We proved that there was an earpiece involved, but how do you prove, unless, you know, like the Popoff case with Randy, unless you've actually recorded what they're hearing through that earpiece, there's no way of proving what information they're getting. They claimed that it was for stage directions. And I kind of wondered what those stage directions might be in a show that's totally ad hoc. You know, walk forward, stop, impersonate dead child, stop, walk off stage, count money. You know, how much stage direction do you need in a mediumship show, you know, yeah, where you're hearing these random voices?
So you mentioned Peter Popoff, who in the 1980s, he's still around. I can't believe he's still out and
yeah, he's still going, and, you know, because he confessed everything after he got busted, and he's now selling miracle water, which cures cancer and AIDS.
Oh, that's good. So, but he was not a psychic, so he was an evangelical preacher who claimed that he was in contact with God, and this is how he knew the information that he knew, and
Was also healing people, I think?
Is that Yes, that's right. Yeah, that's what he was got busted for, because Randy had a scanner which recorded the information he was getting in an earpiece via his wife. And it was nasty stuff as well. It wasn't just information like that guy's got cancer or cataracts or whatever. That, you know, it's kind of really racist abuse, you know, calling people all sorts of names just to identify them in the audience. You know, it was evil all round, basically.
And that's a situation where the racial abuse is the thing that really will stick with people. Not yeah. the fact that he's faking, it's the fact that he's breaking character. That yeah. he's not, you know, he's not a nice guy.
No.
He's a bad guy.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, there's nothing redeeming about him, but it says a lot about the sort of general psyche of the public that, you know, even after confessing what he did and made, you know, millions, if not billions of dollars, you know, he's back doing a very similar thing online, you know, and with TV adverts. And I don't know what it is about, particularly the American psyche, but no one seems kind of obliged to point that out or feels obliged to do that at the moment. And you would think that would be a major exposure, one-off documentary, if nothing else.
I think that in America, there is that idea that, particularly in the evangelical Christian community, that you can be redeemed. And you can be the sinner who has seen the light and come forward and confess.
I'm all for forgiveness to a certain extent, but when you look at what he actually did and what he was, you know, I mean, it's not exactly doing the Christian faith a lot of favours in general, imagery-wise, is it, you know?
No.
If you are a believer, then I would think, you know, he's got to be top of your list of people to expose.
Yeah. How do you feel? Because to me, the idea of someone, say, using an earpiece, that to me is like a magic trick. Not a very good magic trick, but a magic trick. And how do you as a magician feel when you see the techniques of your art form being used in this way?
I think, yeah, it's a fine line between kind of just pointing out what they're doing in general and getting into the whole realms of exposing magic tricks for the sake of making a point, you know. So it's always a hard one because, you know, someone like, you know, a performer like Derren Brown, the sort of mentalist guy, is using exactly the same technique. So you don't really want to kind of give his stuff away just to the public for the sake of it, you know.
Mm.
But I think magicians and mediums in particular, or psychics in general, have always used similar techniques, you know. I mean, what's quite interesting to me is that if you look at, you know, the methods of a particular psychic, mentioning no names again at the moment, they do this thing where they ask people to fill in these love letters before the show, which are little slips of paper. It's so cheeky. It actually says, who you'd like to get a message from in the afterlife, your name, and it actually says at the bottom, not too much information, about 30 words will be fine. So they actually ask for this information, then you put it in a big glass bowl called a psychic orb. It's literally a fish bowl, and it gets taken into the theatre just before the show, and lo and behold, these messages come through from the afterlife. And you go, this is so obvious, you know. Now, say, for example, if someone was slipping out a few bits of paper and reading them and, you know, possibly researching on Facebook or whatever it might be, and then feeding this information through an earpiece, you look back 100 years ago, to Alexander, the famous American mind reader, crystal seer, that's exactly what he was doing. So about 1915, I think it was, he was wireless. He was wearing a big turban on his head, a lopsided turban, because it had a headphone in one side, an early headphone. And he was wireless because he had coils in his Arabian-style slippers and a rug on stage, and it was an induction coil. And he asked people to fill in information before the show. He was actually slightly better, if anything, because people had to seal the stuff in an envelope, which made it harder to read, you know. Put it in a big glass bowl, and lo and behold, someone feeds this information. So you go, not really much has changed in 100 years. It's actually basically the same technique that appears to be being used.
The thing, though, if we see a guy with a turban on stage reading minds, we think, oh, that's a magician.
Or, yeah.
You know, and there's a trick. We don't necessarily know what the trick is, but we know there's a trick. And we're entertained nonetheless because we're at the theatre, and that's fine. However, at the time, there would have been large chunks of the audience who would have believed that he really was in possession of abilities beyond...
Take away the turban and that's still the same situation.
Yeah.
You know, I think what's changed imagery wise is You know, people used to kind of do the whole exotic bit because, you know, most people didn't travel overseas in those days. So anything that was either Egyptian, Arabic, Indian, Chinese would have this, you know, exoticism. And so the thought was that, you know, people believed that certain parts of the world, people had more, you know, intuition or psychic abilities or whatever. So that was played on. Whereas now it's gone completely the opposite way, where it's played on that kind of pseudoscience angle, where it's all about NLP or it's about, you know, body language reading or, you know, forensics, even that kind of thing. So the actual techniques are the same, but they're just clouded in a different imagery, basically, you know.
Now, this is something we were talking about the other day, was the... Like, we'll give you the example we're talking about. So there's routines which are called lie detector routines, and where you bring up a group of people from the audience and they're asked to either lie or tell the truth about a simple prospect, say whether they have a coin in their hand or not. And the audience members are given the choice of whether they're going to lie or tell the truth. And the performer can tell, you know, who's lying, who's telling the truth. And to do that, they will point out, oh, you look to the left and therefore you're accessing the hemisphere of the brain responsible for creativity.
Yeah, your left eye twitched twice.
Yeah. And there's all of these ideas. Another big one that I've seen mentalists using, getting people to draw a capital letter Q on their forehead. Mm-hmm. And if the tail is over the left eye, then it means they've drawn a Q that's designed for the viewer to look at.
Right.
And therefore they're thinking about outward, you know, and therefore they're not necessarily lying, but they're a better liar. All of this sort of stuff.
Yeah.
And when you look carefully at the research, you realize none of that is really true.
No.
At best, it might make you make it a little easier to tell if someone's lying or telling the truth. But there's no Pinocchio's nose, no magic bullet.
Yeah, it's a clever use of misdirection.
That's right.
Basically, what you're doing is offering a pseudo explanation, and while the audience is thinking about that and thinking about the, you know, validity and whether that could actually work, that means their brain's occupied not thinking about, you know, it's actually just someone stood behind them holding up a big card with the answer written on it or whatever it may be.
That's right. Okay, so what then, because I know people, I have friends who are performing magicians who will stand up on stage and say those lies, and they are lies, but they will say them in a way that is so convincing that the audience believes that you really can tell if someone is lying or telling the truth.
Yeah.
Isn't that just as unethical as... not slightly less icky as saying to someone, I can talk to your dead nana.
I think it is. Yeah. I don't have a major issue with people who kind of, you know, pretend to predict the future or talk about general character analysis. I mean, it's not my cup of tea, but what I do have a problem with is the ones who exploit people who are in a particularly, you know, vulnerable situation. In other words, bereaved people, you know, and that's why I have an issue particularly with mediums. You know, it's all part of the same thing. So yeah, you know, in answer to your question, yeah, I do think it's unethical for entertainers to promote things like NLP.
However, personally, I think it's unethical for anyone to promote it.
Yeah, yes,
let's not say entertain. And this is the thing, because there are people who I know have seen Derren Brown perform. The one that I always get is that there's a thing with a red bicycle that he does with Simon Pegg, which listeners should check out because it's a fantastic piece of magic.
Yeah.
And they see this and they believe that Derren Brown is really, via his language and the setup of the room and the tapping of the arm, that he really is influencing Simon Pegg's behavior in that way. And while there's psychology involved, that's not what he's doing.
No.
But those people have then gone out and signed up for NLP courses or pickup artist courses where they're going to learn these sort of techniques of influence.
Sure, yeah.
And they're not going to learn those things. And they are also vulnerable people who are also being...
Yeah, I think it's degrees of vulnerability, really. You know, what gets levelled at me and other sceptics in general is this thing about, well, what's the harm? You know, it's, you know, if it brings a bit of comfort, what harm does it do? You know, contacting the dead or sort of pretending to. And the answer is, you know, quite a lot emotionally. I always look at there's an analogy with bereavement that, you know, getting over someone's death is like a heroin addict going through cold turkey. You know, it's a really difficult thing, but once you're through it, there is some closure, and, you know, it's a big, horrible sort of monster to confront, but you've got to do it.
Mm.
Now, if you go and see a medium and they pretend to contact this person, you're, apart from, you know, replacing your last memories of loved ones with fake, you know, new memories, Basically, what you're doing is preventing closure. So it's a little bit more and a little bit more. So you're going to go back to that medium, paying them, you know, financially apart from anything else. But you're never going to get over it if you think that you can actually still contact a dead person, you know. And there's a really interesting story that, you know, is quite poignant. I was doing some TV stuff about this particular medium when it was all kind of going through the legal process. And someone got in touch and said, just out of interest, a friend of mine, his wife died all of a sudden a couple of years ago after a short illness. And obviously he was distraught about this. And he's normally a really sensible, you know, bright guy. But he ended up going to a medium because it's a last resort thing. You know, you're clutching at straws. And the medium said to him, actually, no, she's free of the pain now and she's in heaven. Everything's good. And she's just waiting, you know, for the day when you join her. And so the guy went and committed suicide on that basis to be with her. And you go, that's what harm it can do. You know, that's not exactly bringing comfort in anyone's book, you know. But the, the other analogy, I think, which is quite important as well, is people go, you know, well, people don't have to go and see a medium. They don't have to pay the money, you know, and if it brings them a bit of comfort. And you go, well, what's the difference between that and an out-and-out con man like a cowboy builder? You know, someone who knocks on an old lady's door and said, there's a few slates missing off your roof, love, you know, I can fix them, but it's, you know, it'll cost you. And they go up in the roof for a few hours, pretend to do some work. They don't. They charge them, you know, $10,000, whatever it may be. And you go, yeah, what harm does it do? Because that old lady didn't have to pay the builder and it's brought her some comfort and some peace of mind. And you go, the difference is that one of those two things is illegal. Being a medium's not, and it's the same thing, you know?
You know, like in broad strokes, what is something we can do to improve the situation?
In a really kind of, I suppose, a militant vein, I'd personally like to see a situation where if someone is charging money for a psychic service, they have to be registered and therefore have to have a qualification and therefore have to prove that they're psychic.
Wait, that you see that as militant?
Well, yeah, in terms of it's bringing in a legality to the situation. I mean, interestingly,
because if I want to be a psychologist, or if I want to be a doctor, if I want to, you know, if I want to be an accountant or something, you know, like I need to be able to provide some degree of accreditation, and you say contacting the other side, that, like, I don't know, I don't see that as militant.
I think, you know, when I say it's sort of a militant viewpoint, I think because it's. You could take it that if you provide any service for money, you know, not just, you know, medical or psychological or whatever it might be, then you should have to be registered, whatever. And you could apply that to art or literature and you go, yeah, you know, you can't sell a painting unless you've been accredited, you know. So
unless you can prove that it is aesthetically uplifting and explores the major themes.
But I think, you know, something, it's a bit like, you know, the whole situation with Simon Singh and the Chiropractors Association, you know. I mean, to be a chiropractor, you don't need qualifications. And so it's up to, you know, to people to point out that, you know, some of them may therefore be quacks, you know. And I think it's the same with psychics. But I think in general, what you can do is just keep pointing out bullshit when you see it. And it's as simple as that. Because the problem is, you know, and I look at particularly on British TV, and the same programmes where we've exposed certain things, psychics and all the rest of it, the next week, they've got another psychic on who's pretending to heal people or whatever it may be. And it's just, it's easy, lazy airtime for TV producers, you know. Mm. Someone come on, and viewers like it. They do like watching it. And I just think it's the duty of skeptics to actually just be that person who's, just when everyone else has reached a consensus or actually doesn't care about the situation, stands up and calls bullshit when they see it, you know. And there doesn't seem to be many people doing that, you know. And the reason being is that it's easy to take legal action against them, you know. And this is what the big name psychics do. It's a form of financial bullying, you know. I mean, if the last action this particular psychic took against me, if it had have gone to court, we're talking about, it's my house on the line. We're not talking about a few, you know, a few hundred dollars here and there. To defend a case like that could cost you, you know, several hundred thousand dollars. And even if you win the case, you're successful in defending it. You're lucky to get maybe 50 or 60% of your legal costs back.
Yeah.
So even as someone who's innocent and right, and can be proved so, you know, in court, then you're still likely to lose a lot of money. And that's a ridiculous situation, you know. So, I mean, going back to the sort of legal side of things, we used to have a thing in the UK which was the Fraudulent Mediums Act, which was actually an extension of the Witchcraft Act, you know, from the 16th century. And, you know, it was basically saying that you can't fraudulently You can't pretend to contact dead people for profit. And I think that should still be in place. And it was cleaned up a few years back. I think it was about, I might be wrong on the figure, but 2009-ish. They cleaned up the laws in England and decided, because it had never been used really, they just got rid of it. So now there is no law against pretending to contact dead people for money. All you have to do if you're doing a live performance is have some sort of line on it saying that it's for entertainment purposes, you know, and they kind of have to have that via the trading standards people. Now, the trading standards people don't really have a lot of authority, and they don't have a lot of money because they're funded by local councils. So say, for example, someone puts in a complaint about a medium. You know, chances are the council will go, well, trading standards will go, well, they're in a different county the next day, it's not worth pursuing. You know, at the very worst, the medium might get a letter saying, don't do that again, or you have to put this on your publicity or whatever. So it's basically down to the general public and sceptics to kind of take the power into their own hands, really, and start messing them about. Again, I think kind of humour and comedy is a good way of doing it. Someone, I can't think who it would be, would, in my locality, just stickers on posters for medium shows saying cancelled due to unforeseen circumstances. you know, and if that means a few less people go to the show, great. If people realise it's a gag, also great. It's taking the mickey out of it. And so I think, you know, direct action on a small and humorous scale is quite effective long term, you know.
Okay, let's flip it around. Let's say we have listeners who are budding con artists themselves and want to go into the trade.
Yeah.
So can we do a crash course in how to be a fake medium?
Yeah. Well, it's just, you know, look at the word bullshit, really, in the dictionary. I mean, I went to see a medium the other day. I went to the Spiritualist Church while I was over here, just out of interest to see how it compared to the British ones. And God, it was dull. It was just so, you know, so lame. And yet these, in the difference actually in the Spiritualist Church from the most of the stage mediums is they actually, you know, are genuinely believe what they're doing, you know.
Yeah.
And it was really interesting psychology to watch this medium who gave a really bad, boring lecture about the history of spiritualism while acknowledging that the various characters that she mentioned, including the Fox sisters, were frauds, you know, but yet she still, you know, that didn't seem to matter, you know, because she was so convinced that spiritualism exists. But then the second half of it, after singing all these awful songs, was her doing readings, and it was the most obvious basic cold reading I think I've ever seen. You know, I mean, there are about 30 people in there.
What sort of things? Like what?
There's an older man, and I'm feeling some kind of tightness or pain in the upper part of the body, somewhere around here, and she's gesturing the whole torso, basically. And he's an older man. He hasn't got all his hair, but at one point he did have a full head of hair. And he's showing me.
No, because all of the bald people I know were born bald.
Absolutely, yeah. There was never a phase in between where they had hair. Yeah. And he's showing me his hands, and he's got kind of calloused hands, you know. And so, I mean, what are the chances that someone in an audience of 30-odd has known an older man who at some stage was younger, who's not got all his hair, but did have a full head of hair, who did manual labour, presumably, you know, and it was that basic. And there was a whole G, I'm getting a G name. And you go, right, is this a spelling thing? Are you seeing the letter G? Are you hearing it? And apparently she's hearing it. And you go, why is it just the letter then that you're pointing out? You know, it's just, it was bad beyond belief. The closest it got to a specific thing that someone could pick up on, although they were clamouring, falling over each other to try and take the reading, the audience, said that there's a taller woman. And this taller woman, and she's kind of short of breath. Did she like music? And eventually this guy offered a name. You know, she hadn't suggested a name herself, and you know, it was very definitely her that had come through to him. And she said, and she was tall, wasn't she? And he went, no. So actually the one specific she'd given about this one being tall was the one thing that didn't fit. You know, and it's just, she didn't actually use many Barnum statements, you know, those deliberately geared statements which kind of sound specific to a person but are really vague, you know.
Something, circuses should have something for everybody, so, yeah.
Yeah, you know, one of the favourite ones is, you know, there's a scar on your knee at this side, and so they gesture to one side, so it's great because that a lot of people have a small scar somewhere near the knee, and the great thing about doing it this side is it means, you know, if it can be a mirror image of the person, or or not.
Oh, it could be my right or your right. Yeah. That's great.
Yeah, there's all that sort of stuff. And there's one I've heard a lot recently that was quite interesting. I'm not sure where it comes from, but there's something to do with, and he was buried without his shoes. And you go, that sounds quite specific.
Yeah.
But actually, when you look into it, I think it's particularly an Irish trait. A lot of people in Ireland are buried without shoes for whatever reason. It's just a tradition thing. But also for medical conditions. A lot of people's feet swell because of various things when they're in a hospital bed.
That's great.
So the shoes don't fit for being buried. So that's a great one, actually. But And the first time I heard it, it didn't register. But when I heard it in three separate occasions with mediums, you go, that's a really good one, you know. There's also, I think a house fire. There's psychologically, apparently a lot of middle-aged women are frightened of domestic fires. I think we all are to a certain extent, but there's something, I don't know why that triggers, And so, there's all these things that you can say that sound incredibly specific to someone, and hence this phrase that you get sick and tired of hearing that, my mother went to see me and they told her something they couldn't possibly have known. You say, go and see a magician and he'll tell the card that you chose that he couldn't possibly have known.
Yeah.
But because it's not cloaked as a trick, they just refuse to believe that it could be a trick.
Well, that's the big difference. And that's the big thing, is it's always about context.
Yeah.
And you can have the worst psychic in the world, and in the correct context, they will be believed. If you have if the person, the victim, is, already believes and is in a vulnerable state, and if they... they're in a setting and environment. They're at a psychic expo, or
Totally.
You do have psychic expos in.
We've got psychic fairs. They call
psychic
it.
Fairs. They're great. It's phenomenal.
I went to one a bit ago, but I had to leave quite shortly because a few people kind of recognised me, and it was kind of that sort of scene in Hitchcock of the birds when they start kind of gathering. I didn't feel very welcome.
Richard Sanders goes and actually does. Like workshops, and because you can, some of them, if you just pay and sign up, you can do whatever you want. So that you get lines up and does like workshops on basically faking, how to make sure you're not being taken advantage of.
I think what's interesting is a lot of even magicians and people who do kind of, mentalism for a living think that the psychics use far more complex methods than they do. I mean, the methods of mediums are usually far more basic than magicians, If you're going to predict something as a magician, you might use a particular prop or a bit of an electronic wizardry to help you out.
Mm.
Whereas they're not generally doing anything like that. I think, in the old days, it was kind of traditional for mediums to just walk around the local graveyard and look at, names and dates and see, someone who'd been freshly buried or whatever, and use that information. Nowadays, obviously, local newspaper obituaries was the other way. Nowadays, it's so much easier because you've got the obituaries online and all the rest of it. But you've also got, Facebook is about as complex as it gets. A medium will, basically sort of have their own page. It's amazing how many people will like that page and say, coming to see you tomorrow night, can't wait to see, I'm hoping to get a message from the Auntie Dot, and not realizing about liking that, their whole page is open. So photographs, family names, the discussions, all the rest of it is wide open there. All the medium needs to do.
Do you like... I'm sensing Candy Crush. Is that? Sorry, is that? Yeah. Are those words?
Do you live alone with a cat? That would apply to probably half the audience.
I can see a picture, and it's got trite words. It's a picture of a sunset with trite words written over the top.
Yeah, yeah. Does a mem or meme mean anything to you?
Meme
as in meaningless.
Meaningless. Yeah.
But it's quite incredible, and people don't realize how little information can go a long way. I mean, I've kind of watched various mediums who are doing probably on stage for an hour and a half maybe, and all they're really doing is 10 readings overall, and there's all these kind of like subtle little things, does this mean anything to you, and he hasn't passed yet, has he, and it's all this kind of he's asking questions rather than giving information. But what they'll do then is get them to stand up, and who are you with, because you need a bit of support. So there'll be three or four people stand up together, so and that was meant for you, not you, and so you're quadrupling your chance immediately. But I mean, it's still amazing how bad they are on odd occasions. I mean, this particular one I went to see, working in an audience of probably 1,800 to 2,000 people, went through 11 names at the start of the show before they got a hit. Now, you're talking an audience almost exclusively of middle to old age women. Is that a Pam or a Pat or a Dorothy or a Dot or a Margaret or a Sue? And 11 names before they got a hit out of 2,000 people. I mean, that's almost statistically impossible.
Yeah.
You know? And you can watch all this and see a really bad show, and yet the people still believe. And I think it's a bit like the Magician's Too Perfect theory. If there were so many strong hits, it would be too unbelievable.
Mm.
But because there's one specific or two specifics in an hour and a half show, then it has to be real, because she couldn't have known that, you know?
Yeah, and that's all you need. Whereas a magician who does the same is not... Oh, I've seen shows like that where just every single... I saw a hypnotism show once in which there was really loud noise bleed from the theatre next door, and his headset microphone was just staticky. And in the course of an hour, he didn't hypnotize anyone. Literally no one was hypnotized. Yeah. And that's in a setting where people sometimes just pretend to be hypnotized to be polite, but they couldn't even fake it. The noise was that sort of line there, waking up. I was talking to a group of high school students, there's about 200 of them, and I was explaining what cold reading is. And I said, you know, cold reading is the idea that they'll use very vague statements that feel very specific to you. You know, for example, I might say that you're, you know, like for you guys, I see, well, you're obviously, you know, teenagers, and it was a girls' school and you're all girls. So I might say something like, you're very worried because you're having a lot of conflict in your family. In fact, I think someone is having a lot of trouble with their little brother at the moment. And a girl in the front row gasped audibly. And I said, oh, see, there we go. There's our hit right there. And after which comes, she goes, how did you know that I was having these fights? And I've got, no, but I just, it was in the context of an explanation of how it's done in a show called The Bad Science Show about critical thinking and bullshit. And they still believe that I had psychic powers.
You've hit the nail on the head in the sense that what we're battling against is people want to believe. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, at best, you're going to look like a spoil sport.
Yeah.
You know, but the amount of venom, because people have got so much invested emotionally, you know. If someone has been to see a medium and they are convinced that medium has contacted their dead relative, you saying, you know, rubbishing that idea, you're not going to be popular, you mm-hmm. know. And so it is a really hard line to tread, really. You know, you can just look, as you mentioned earlier, incredibly cynical, you know. And so it's very hard. That's why I think the humour is important. If you can do it with a bit of a wink and a grin, then at least, you know, you might be ridiculing it, but at least you're doing it with some warmth, you know.
It reminds me of Penn and Teller's Bullshit, where they say that they can't, you know, they can be sued for libel if they say that someone is a fraud or a con artist or a fake, but so instead they're going to call them assholes and motherfuckers. It's a nice way of doing it.
I mean, I did a lecture at Goldsmiths University in London, and it was a really interesting question at the end of it, where someone said, "Well, I've got a neighbour, and they lost their child, and they've been seeing a medium from time to time about it, and they seem, you know, much more relaxed now, and they're kind of happy with it. Should I tell them it's bullshit? You know, should I explain what's going on?" And I didn't really have an answer for that, actually, because, you know, it's kind of too far down the line at that stage in some respects, you know. And what would you be gaining for them? You know, it's kind of in contradiction to what I was saying about what comfort does it bring. You know, it definitely can bring some comfort, but it's a false comfort. And I don't think that's a good thing to have. So the only thing you can do is try to stop that happening in the first place. Once it's happened, I don't think there's any point hammering it home with someone who's actually, you know, got something out of it, sadly, you know.
Maybe this is where the militant skeptic needs to come in, and you say, yes, you do. And that's going to break that person's heart. You know what? It's collateral damage, because we're fighting.
Yeah.
You're fighting a bigger battle. And
it's, you know,
that person, you know, that medium is making money from that person, and that medium is staying in business, and they're going to find more customers and more people. And you need to, you know, you need to cut the snake off at the head. And you need to debunk them and defraud them.
It's a fair point. I think, but, you know, given that situation, it should be the medium you're targeting rather than the victim.
Like I said, collateral damage.
It's connected, obviously, yeah.
I mean, I'm not going to do this myself because I'm a terrible coward, but someone else should do it.
Yeah. It's you know, there isn't a cut and dried easy answer for everything, you know. But I think all you can do in general is kind of, you know, bring the topic up. And particularly when it's on TV, because that's reaching a lot of people, you know.
Mm.
And, you know, tweet about the fact that it's bullshit while it's on, you know, and just use their platform to balance it. They, you know, TV companies are supposed to have balance, particularly the BBC in the UK. If they have someone on claiming these ridiculous abilities, they should have someone on questioning it, you know. And they don't. It only seems to be one way around. If you have a skeptic who's on talking about something, then they have to have a believer to balance it. But it doesn't happen the other way around all that often.
No.
So, but, you know, something like Twitter is a good platform for that, you know, because you can actually get out there and voice your opinion, obviously, at the time, you know, rather than writing a stern letter a couple of days later.
Yeah. I guess, though, there is always that problem that as soon as you have two people arguing on two different sides of an issue, it creates the impression that those are two equally valid arguments, and that the viewer is whatever they choose is their own personal choice.
You know, yeah, I mean, totally.
The one that everyone talks about at the moment is climate change, where whenever there's a discussion of climate change, you'll have someone who says, no, there's no such thing as climate change. Yeah. And then you'll have someone who says, well, this is what the science says. And those two people are somehow considered equally valid.
Yeah, or any political debate. You know?
Yeah. That's right. Yeah, any political debate. And it is a political issue, though, I think, the issue. I mean, we, as skeptics, we like to think of it as a scientific, you know, empirical. It's much like climate change, that these are what the facts say, and this is what we know and what we don't know and what we need to learn.
Yeah.
But it's a political issue.
Yeah. And actually, to be fair, the believers have a very good answer to that by saying, well, it's not everything can be mentioned but measured by science. And you go, well, it kind of can if it exists, or at some stage in the future may be able to, you know. And there's that kind of mistaken idea that, you know, well, it's not a mistaken idea, but, you know, the idea that science can't explain everything. And, but the difference is that science tries to explain things, and it changes its viewpoint once the evidence is presented. All we're asking for is some evidence. And it is quite incredible that, you know, there is such an industry in everything psychic-wise, New Age-wise, whatever. You know, there's a lot of money being made, but absolutely no kind of, legal situation where you can actually question anything, you know. What other industry without any evidence whatsoever could you make that much money from, you know?
So what you're saying is we're in the wrong business.
Yeah, I think, you know, if you don't have a moral viewpoint, my advice would be, you know, it's L. Ron Hubbard, isn't it? You know, I'm going to get into religion. That's where the money is.
Right.
Is that not a clue to Scientology? Is that he said that before setting up the Scientology movement, you know?
All right. So for our budding psychics, one is you need to have lax morals, get your cold reading down pat.
Yeah.
Focus on the context. Use social media to do your research.
And just throw in odd things as well, you know, that are specifics, because one day one's going to hit so hard, you know. So if you're giving someone a half-hour reading or whatever, you've got all these vagaries. You've got the Barnum statements, the cold reading, all the rest of it. And obviously you can tell, you know, for one-to-one readings, you can tell so much about a person's appearance. You know, it's not exactly cold reading. It's more hot reading. I mean, that's something I used to use a lot when I was kind of playing with this stuff that way. But also, if you just throw in, you know, a number, or, you know, I'm seeing a green door and it's number 33, but it might not be, or possibly it's just a 3, but it might not be the number on the door. It might be a date or whatever. So you're throwing these things, and if any of that hits, it sounds so specific. And what they will remember afterwards is that you saw a green front door with the number 33, and that's where my Auntie Mary lived.
Yeah.
You know, or, you know, and she was born on the 3rd of March, which is the third month of the year, whatever. And but that's what they'll remember, not realizing that you've thrown in these generalizations as well as a real specific.
I also enjoy when they say a rhetorical question, a question that can either be a literal question, or it can be a rhetorical question. So you can say, you're not a Virgo, are you? And if they say yes, they go, oh, yeah, I thought so.
Yeah.
And if they say no, you can say, oh, I didn't think so. Like it's
I overheard someone doing some tarot card reading in a shop. I'm trying to remember where it was, actually. It was somewhere in England, just driving through the countryside, and there was this kind of New Age shop, so we called in. And I was just listening to this. This woman said, so you've got two children. And she said, no, I haven't got any children. But there is a young lady. Okay, yeah. Okay. See, the problem is sometimes I get the exact opposite of what's true. Bit of a no-lose situation then, really.
That's fantastic. Yeah. Sometimes I get the exact opposite of what's true. And that, do you know what? There is a sort of weird, twisted logic. Like, I can't, you imagine a polarized photograph, yeah. Negative. Oh,
there was a lovely one at this spiritualist meeting the other week. Mirror image. Yeah. This woman doing the mediumship demonstration. And what was it she said? Oh, that's right. You can't ask any questions. Once I make contact with the spirit and I'm working with an individual, that individual can't ask me or the spirit any questions. Because if you do, my logical mind jumps in. And I don't want to influence it in any way.
The last thing you want to do is bring logic into the
absolutely.
Situation.
Yeah. So what would be the point of this contact with a dead relative if you can't ask them anything? You know, it's just nonsense.
It's just nonsense. Wise words from Paul Bennett. Thank you very much for coming on Scammapalooza. Do you have anything to plug at the moment?
Not really, no.
Your books are still out there, though.
Actually, they've just been republished, actually, under different names.
Been published under a few different names.
They have, yeah.
Because the original name was, is it 100 Ways to Win a Tenner?
100 Ways to Win a Tenner, which came out in Australia as Bar Bets.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I strip it right back down to basics.
And the cover is... I've got it. I can't see it on the bookcase right now, but right, I have it. Yeah. It's just green with some
You know,
the original one's great. The original cover.
Yeah, well, they did one as well called Paul Zenon's Dirty Tricks, which is kind of practical joke stuff and whatever. But they've re-released them both under the titles Practical Jokes and Practical Magic. Mm-hmm. You see what happened?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, yeah, we got those. And actually, a deck of cards that I designed with my mate Vince Ray, who's a great sort of cult comic book artist, really, does sort of tattoo style stuff, called the Z-Ray deck. So for magicians, it's on sort of bicycle brand playing cards, which are, you know, for non-magicians are top quality kind of thing. So we got that out. There's a website with them on call. I think it's zraydeck.com. Whatever.
Right.
So, but not particularly relevant, but I'll plug anything anywhere if I can. So there you go.
This has been Scammapalooza. For more information on today's show, check out conman.com.au.